The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Earlier this summer, the University of New Hampshire was caught off guard when the online publication campusreform.org published excerpts from a bias-free language guide posted on the UNH website. The preferred language guide stated, among other things, that the adjective American is outdated and problematic, and that U.S. citizen, resident of the U.S., or North American should be used instead. UNH President Mark Huddleston condemned the guide and released a statement saying that it did not reflect university policy and, quote, "It is ironic that what was probably a well-meaning effort to be sensitive proves offensive to many people, myself included." That level of sensitivity to words and ideas is why comedians Chris Rock and Jerry Seinfeld say they no longer perform on college campuses. In a cover story for The Atlantic magazine called The Coddling of the American Mind, Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt propose that it is not only disastrous for education, but for mental health. And Greg Lukianoff is with us. Thank you for joining us for On Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how does that story of the preferred language guide illustrate the coddling that you write about?
Well, it's part of a larger trend of language policing that's been going on campuses for decades. It just seems to have gotten, and I'm a First Amendment lawyer, that's my background, and I've been defending free speech rights on college campuses ever since I got out of law school back in 2001. But something's gotten more intense in the past 2 years, and the level of language policing has stepped up, and to a large degree, it seems to be coming from students. Now, University of New Hampshire is a particularly interesting case because while they focused a lot on calling someone American might be problematic or a microaggression, there were so many other things that I found fascinating about it, not the least of which is they said that the word Arab could be found problematic and offensive, which sounded like something right out of a parody. It's like you're actually saying that where someone's from is actually offensive just right off the bat. That's crazy.
Who creates those kind of policies?
Sometimes it's administrators. Sometimes it's the students themselves, like at Ithaca College, where they created a microaggressions reporting system, which, it's supposed to actually help students talk across lines of difference, but it includes, reporting, it includes keeping track of the demographics of both the microaggressor and the microaggressed against. And I made a point in the Huffington Post, it's like, if you actually think this is going to make people more comfortable to engage in candor across lines of difference, I think you're kidding yourselves.
What are microaggressions exactly?
Microaggressions are unconscious slights, and the term was coined in the 1970s by a professor who was interested in unconscious racist slights. So, for example, like someone who meets someone who's African American, and they really emphasize, "My, aren't you articulate?" Now, that's obnoxious, and those kind of slights are very interesting to study. But when people start policing them in a way that actually causes everyone to watch every word they say, you end up interfering with candor, you end up interfering with free speech. And it's one of those things that I talk about. If we really want people to get to know each other, we really want to bridge boundaries, the kind of safe spaces we should be creating are spaces where it's safe to be wrong.
The culture that you say is being created, you call vindictive protectiveness. What does that mean?
That's the edge that we've seen in the last couple of years. And what we mean by that is, in an effort to protect victim groups usually, there's been a lot more language policing in the form of microaggressions policing, in the form of speech codes, in the form of demanding apologies or people be fired. And what's interesting is when I watch this time and time again, it's not usually coming from the people who are themselves the supposed victim group. It's coming from people who have sort of taken on the cause of protecting them. And to me, it always has a little bit of a Victorian, a little bit of a patronizing element to it. But it has gotten particularly sharp in the past year.
You're talking about the last couple of years. Can you kind of trace a starting point for when this started playing out on campuses across the country?
I definitely noticed an uptick right around the time at Brown University. Ray Kelly was supposed to speak there. And Ray Kelly is the person who's responsible for the Stop and Frisk program in New York. But what had happened at his Brown speech is student protests, which were originally focusing on getting him disinvited, actually got him to concede to do an extensive question and answer period where you know, if you really wanted to ask Ray Kelly a hard question, he was giving you the opportunity to. So for us free speech people, us academic freedom people, this was great. But instead what happened after this concession, students nonetheless showed up and shouted so loud for half an hour that they just called off the speech, which of course was the most frustrating to the activists who really wanted to ask Ray Kelly some hard questions. And it seemed like something that seemed to be almost, I'm not sure if it was a turning point or if just noticing it more, whereas generally, a lot of what we fought on campuses were administrators who were out of control, who were just sort of throwing their weight around. It's been, as I said, coming more from students lately.
Well, you and your co-author identify a number of new practices and pieces of language making their way into college lectures and discourse. You mentioned microaggressions, vindictive protectiveness. But trigger warnings, what are they? And give us some cases where they've come up.
Trigger warnings, you know, they started in a very well-intended way, and as best we can tell, they started mostly in the on campuses, and then moved to the feminist blogosphere, and primarily dealing with people discussing sexual assault, and what they would and there'd be whole forums devoted to talking about sexual assault, and someone would put in front of that trigger warning where I'm about to discuss in graphic detail what happened to me, and that's very much understandable. They managed to start popping up on college campuses in the past 2 years. And again, I think they're generally well-intentioned. But, you know, I'll give some examples of things that I've heard from professors students have demanded trigger warnings for. Probably the most ridiculous one I've heard was a social psychology professor told being chastised by a student for not providing a trigger warning before a discussion of Pavlov's dog because the Pavlov's dog story involved animal cruelty. And this... And I understand why professors are worried about that. Now, to explain, some professors think these are great and think that they're not a problem at all. My concern as a First Amendment person is if you create an expectation that it's up to the professor to anticipate everything that a student might find upsetting and warn them in advance, you're putting them in an impossible situation. And that's exactly what seven humanities professors wrote to Inside Higher Education last year.
The offense is all in the judgment of the person who is being triggered. And this is part of your big argument here, that advocating for trigger warnings policies to protect emotional well-being and zero tolerance for microaggressions actually harm students psychologically. How?
The primary way it works is just by looking at your own automatic thoughts and asking yourself, is this reasonable? Is this fair? Am I arguing fairly with myself? Or am I exaggerating what's going on? Am I, for example, engaged in dichotomous thinking? Am I thinking that if I don't do well at this interview, my life is over, or if this person breaks up with me, that's it for me? That's a classic cognitive distortion. And in my experience on campus, what I've seen is, what I believe is a lot of teaching students through example, primarily from administrators, thinking that something relatively small that's happened means it's going to be a catastrophe, is a behavior I think that gets modeled for students from K through 12 all the way up through college. And I think that this sort of overprotectiveness that we've hoisted upon students is resulting in students who actually believe that they're much more fragile than they are. And this can actually be a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I'm talking with Greg Lukianoff of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. He's also co-author of an article for The Atlantic called The Coddling of the American Mind, which criticizes the tiptoeing or avoiding literature, perspectives, and ideas that college students might find upsetting. Their conclusion, it's not only bad for education, but for mental health and development. Well, it is easy to say students who are rallying against the offensive speech are being oversensitive. But isn't this how many social shifts have happened historically? You know, people saying it is not okay to call that man AX or that woman X. You know what I mean? That not letting those things slide.
Absolutely. I agree that a lot of what is sort of roughly called political correctness is sort of an overcorrection that ends up sometimes being taken too far.
I'm thinking of the New York Times depiction of the corporate culture at Amazon. Did you read that article or hear about it?
I haven't read. I heard a lot about it, though.
Well, it's predominantly male leadership and similarly Silicon Valley bro culture. I mean, a lot of it is really offensive. So I guess that's the question. I mean, you're a First Amendment lawyer. Where do you draw the line between what is and what isn't offensive?
Well, what is and what isn't offensive? I mean, First Amendment lawyers don't so much draw the line between what is and what isn't offensive. We draw the line between what is and what isn't protected. So I'm sort of wearing a different hat for this article. But as a First Amendment lawyer, I don't think people should be, you know, going to jail for being offensive. I don't think it should be a crime to be offensive. I think that would be a terrible idea. But I do think that, you know, calling people out when they've been when they're being offensive or being insensitive is the right way to handle these issues. But I do at the same time, as I wrote in my book, Freedom from Speech, I think that we've been not even hearing each other out at all lately as a society and to a degree on campus. So I advocate, you know, some of these very old-fashioned ideas, like try to hear what someone's saying first before you assume that they shouldn't have said it in the first place.
Hmm. Well, your organization has defended students and faculty who oppose or have been who have lost or left jobs, academic jobs, or been written up for offenses.
Yep.
In your conversations with them, how has this sensitivity changed academia?
Well, it's been interesting because, you know, for a long time, we've defended professors for our entire history. We defended students for our entire history. But in the past couple of years, particularly when I'm doing radio shows, I've had a lot more professors calling in saying they're freaked out, that essentially they're afraid that it's just way too easy to say the wrong thing. It doesn't. And this is part of the problem is we don't count someone's intention at all anymore. Like if you say something that offends a student, it's all entirely on you. And that's a very hard environment in which to teach serious things. So I thought Jeannie Sook's article, she's a Harvard Law professor in The New Yorker this year, where she talked about how increasingly students are requesting that professors not teach law related to sexual assault in law school, and how troubling that is, because in the attempt to sort of avoid radioactive or difficult topics, we're engaged in a behavior that actually would, of course, most hurt victims of sexual assault who might need a lawyer who knows a little bit about the law around it. So I do think that in some cases, taken too far, this language policing is preventing conversations we desperately need to have.
So what is the solution? I mean, you're talking about undoing decades of protective parenting and movements for complete inclusiveness.
Well, you know, we're trying to offer a solution in our article, which is I think people should learn a little bit more about cognitive behavioral therapy and cognitive distortions, in part because I think they're just in general good rules for how to argue productively. I think we should be teaching people debate and discussion. I think we should be teaching people how to civilly disagree, how to actually have a meaty discussion. And I think universities should be inculcating this. So, you know, as a free speech advocate, I was one of the biggest boosters of Twitter, particularly when it first started, because I felt like it was the closest we've ever seen to sort of the collective unconscious of the entire species. Because when you get to see what people say without thinking about it and say it as quickly as possible in reaction to what they're seeing, you get to see something, some very deep and sometimes not entirely pleasant aspects of human nature, but interesting nonetheless. And I think that there was, you know, for a while there, at least on Twitter, there was an understanding that in 140 characters, you're going to have to give some benefit of the doubt. You're going to have to assume that you don't entirely know what someone meant by that tweet. And somehow it just seems like that's entirely reversed. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, John Ronson's book, you know, So You've Been Publicly Shamed is so terrific, is because it actually checks us for a second to say, wait a second, hold on, we're just dying to shut down debate and discussion. We're just dying to actually find someone to villainize so we can go after them if they say something wrong on Twitter, which is not the way I think we should be thinking about it.
Well, social media, it's quite easy to be indignant on social media, and there are very little consequences in the human scale.
Yeah, Bill Maher wrote a great article in the New York Times several years ago talking about the Let's Not Be Offended Day, calling out what he saw as feigned offendedness, and just making the point that, yeah, sometimes people are offended. Sometimes people are offended too easily, but sometimes they don't really mean it. Sometimes it's just a sort of pantomime to go after views or people you dislike. And so what I am saying and what Bill Maher was saying is sometimes it's tactical. Sometimes it's insincere and it's used as a weapon in this increasingly sort of polarized political debate that we have. And it's interesting to watch how some of the sharpest criticisms aren't so much across groups. They seem to be increasingly like within, where it's essentially whether it's on the right or the left, that how quickly people accuse someone of not being pure enough or being a traitor in vitriolic language that, again, I believe should be protected. But there are better ways to argue about things than we're currently engaged in.
Okay, so it looks like all those kids whose parents tried to control their environment when they were growing up have successfully controlled their environment, you know, against any kind of potentially offensive language or concepts. So what is getting lost from a college education?
Well, I think we're doing students to a degree a great disservice, because the simple fact is that's represented both by cognitive behavioral therapy and the wisdoms of the ancients going back to Marcus Aurelius and the Buddha is that you cannot control the facts of the world around you. And if you believe you can, you're going to be constantly disappointed. But what you can control is how you think about them. And one of the things that's wonderful about CBT is it empowers students to live in the world as it is, as opposed to flee from it.
Well, Greg, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Greg Lukianoff, he is president and CEO of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. He's co-author of the cover story for The Atlantic magazine. It's called The Coddling of the American Mind. You'll find a link to read the article for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Each year, thousands of kids are arrested in school. About one-third of U.S. schools have a regular police presence on campus, and some districts employ their own police forces. As the number of law enforcement officers on campuses has gone up, so too have the number of arrests. And navigating the line between discipline and law enforcement is anything but simple. Life of the Law's Alisa Roth brings us the story.
As bad as the name sounds, it wasn't his hit list that got Kyle Thompson arrested during fourth period biology. His teacher, Beth DiPonio, had noticed him messing around with the paper on which he had written a list of names, including his teachers, and the reason why each was on the list. She tried to take it away. Kyle didn't want her to get it.
When we were pulling it back and forth, she was laughing at first, so I thought it was just as a joke, but...
He says he let go when he realized she was serious. DiPonio declined to be interviewed, but in a statement to the school district, she wrote that Kyle had grabbed her and was very aggressive. Whatever the case, Kyle ended up in the office, where the school police officer handcuffed him and took him to the police station.
The scariest part was probably being handcuffed and inside of there, just realizing that I'm in there.
About a third of schools in the U.S. have police officers in them to protect students, teachers, and administrators from anything from gang violence to attacks like what happened in Newtown. But as more police have ended up in schools, more students have been getting arrested, and often for minor offenses. It raises some interesting legal questions.
There certainly is a line where something crosses, for instance, from a shoving match to an assault.
Mo Kennedy is executive director of the National Association of School Resource Officers, or SROs, an organization that trains officers to work in schools.
When a teacher says that they've been assaulted, you know, that has to be investigated to some degree.
Kennedy says school police should not act as disciplinarians. So, for example, they shouldn't be meting out detentions. But it can sometimes be hard to say where a disciplinary matter ends and a criminal justice matter begins. For some people, the solution is to give kids room to be kids. Judge Stephen Teske is a juvenile judge in Clayton County, Georgia. He realized that a lot of kids were ending up in his court for what amounted to stupid behavior.
You know, really what it comes down to is that, is this a kid who scares me versus a kid who makes me mad?
So he and other stakeholders changed the rules in his district. A lot of offenses would no longer land a kid in the criminal justice system, at least not right away. The number of students who ended up in his courtroom dropped almost immediately. But while students are protected by the Constitution just like the rest of us, schools are different. For example, a principal may search students' bags or lockers much more easily than a police officer on the street. The problem is when police are regularly present in the schools, it's not always clear which standards apply. Christy Bowman is a law professor at Michigan State.
Whether the SRO is an agent of the school or an agent of the police force could impact the standard for search and seizure. It could impact whether a student needs to have his or her Miranda rights read.
In Kyle Thompson's case, nobody told him that he had the right to remain silent or that anything he said could be used against him in court. But it's not always obvious in the school setting when a person has to be read his Miranda rights. And whether Kyle should have been read those rights or not, he ended up in handcuffs in the local police station, wondering how he'd ended up there.
I know I've made mistakes, but I just didn't think it was as big as others.
The criminal case against Kyle for assaulting the teacher got dismissed. He was suspended from school for 180 days, but he's now getting A's at a new Christian school. But there's another more challenging dimension to this problem, which is race. While there's no evidence that Kyle's race was an issue, he is African American, African American boys are arrested in school disproportionately often. Last month, Attorney General Eric Holder asked schools to reconsider their disciplinary policies.
A routine school discipline infraction should land a student in the principal's office, not in a police precinct.
He also presented new guidelines for school discipline. The administration hopes will make stories like Kyle's much less common. For Life of the Law, I'm Melissa Roth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. With the trans celebrities Caitlyn Jenner and Laverne Cox in the spotlight, more and more individuals are coming forward with their own stories about gender ambiguity, which from a biological perspective is a lot more common than most people think. Studies at Brown University found that one out of every 2,000 people is born with ambiguous genitalia or other traits that fall somewhere on the male-female spectrum, but many of them grow up without knowing it. Doctors regularly perform surgeries on infants that will determine which gender that child will identify with for life. An increasing number of parents, legal experts, and bioethicists are questioning whether intersex babies should be operated on. The first public lawsuit on that question is scheduled for November. Azeen Ghoreshi, a science reporter for BuzzFeed News and author of the article Born in Between, Should Doctors Operate on Intersex Babies? And Azeen, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, you focus on a lawsuit over a child called MC in the article, stemming from the circumstances of the child's birth. Now, what was the condition?
So MC was born with ovotesticular disorder of sexual development. It's an incredibly rare form of intersex. It's about one in every 20,000 babies are born with this particular condition. So it's basically that he has both ovarian and testicular tissue. He's pretty much split down the middle in terms of which biological traits are female and which biological traits are male. So it presents a little bit more difficult of a quandary for doctors at birth about what to do and sort of, you know, guessing what gender he's going to grow up to identify with.
And you call him he. What did they do for MC?
So MC was actually a ward of the state by the time doctors were trying to determine whether to operate on him. So the state was really making the decisions about his care, which is part of the lawsuit, actually. The doctors looked at all of his genetic information, looked at his anatomy, which included a penis and a vagina. It included one testicle, and like I said, both ovarian and testicular tissue. And they basically determined that he could have gone either way. If you look at the doctor's notes, when MC was 60 months old, they basically said that it was very, very hard to determine sort of which way he was going to swing, and they could swing it kind of in either direction based on how they decided to operate is sort of the language that they were using. One key thing was that he did have fairly high levels of testosterone at birth that are usually normal for males of his same age. But ultimately, they decided to go with a female gender assignment. So they removed all of his male anatomy and assigned him as a female. Of course, now I'm using the male gender pronoun. He is now 10 years old and identifies as a boy.
Well, Azine, data from Brown University estimates one in every 2,000 babies born in the U.S. have a range of traits, you know, falling somewhere on this spectrum of male and female. But you found some doctors argue that it could be even higher.
Right. So it sort of depends on where you decide to draw the line on what is intersex and what isn't. Doctors and scientists are basically finding out that there are more and more and more ways that there isn't this perfect binary of sex of male and female. But some doctors do say that it could be as many as 1 in 100 babies that are born with intersex conditions.
Well, tell us about this lawsuit. This is Pam and Mark Crawford, who adopted MC, or are they foster parents?
They adopted him, yeah.
In the state of South Carolina. So what is the argument the Crawfords are making?
So they adopted MC. I think they brought him home at the age of 20 months. And he was, at that point, they had brought home a baby girl. They knew about his condition, and they actually, Pam had grown up, and one of her friends had actually had an intersex condition. And so she was a little bit more aware of sort of the issues around it. First thing she said when she found out about MC's condition was, have they done surgery? And they said yes, and she was pretty disappointed about that. Mm-hmm. But anyways, they brought home this baby girl. They raised her as a baby girl until about the age of 4. So I think MC started sort of asserting a little bit more boyish behaviors, you know, playing with trucks and wanting to be on the boys' team and all these things that they didn't make too much of, just because Pam and Mark are both, I'd say, a little bit on the hippie side. They're like, you know, not one to dress her up in a pink dress or anything like that. They were definitely, they'd raised a tomboy before and weren't going to read too much into anything like that. But as he got older, he sort of started making these stronger and stronger assertions. He asked to have his hair cut like dad's, which, you know, they explained that he might be mixed up with a boy, and MC said that he didn't mind. They went on a family trip to a water park, and MC begged his mom to please be allowed to exist there as a boy. At this point, I think the parents started to see that maybe there was something going on. And I think at the age of 7, he decided that he wanted to, that he was a boy, and that's really just what he was. So he went in front of his class, and he told them, and it was his words, actually, the born in between that we used in our headline was actually straight out of the mouth of a 7-year-old, which is about the simplest way to put it.
So what's the nature of the suit, and why is it against the doctor who made the decision?
So they are not suing over the fact that they got his gender wrong, right? That MC was surgically altered to be a girl and that he is now grown into being a boy. They are suing over the issue of informed consent. They are alleging that the doctors did not do enough to inform his caregivers at the time, which were social workers for the state of South Carolina and foster parents. They're alleging that they did not pose enough of an option of not doing the surgery and did not make clear enough the sort of potential negative consequences of doing the surgery itself.
In their mind, what would those negative consequences be?
Well, MC, for example, now cannot procreate as a male. Obviously, that's a big one. There's psychological impacts of the surgery happening. The possibility that he was going to grow into being a boy and the sort of gender dysmorphia that comes with that is something he's going to have to deal with for the rest of his life. He's going to have to go on to hormone therapy at this point once he hits puberty to continue to live as a boy. These are all risks that the Crawfords are alleging the doctors should have informed his caregivers of.
We're speaking with Azine Gureishi. She's science reporter for BuzzFeed News. And she wrote about a lawsuit involving a commonly performed surgical procedure on babies who are born intersex or with ambiguous genitalia. So the doctors make decisions pretty much on the spot. Are there any qualms within the field of medicine about this informed consent, you know, picking one gender over the other?
Actually, I mean, the standard of care has changed a lot since this practice pretty much started in the mid-50s. You know, the kids that were originally operated on when this sort of rolled out in American medicine, their parents kept it secret from them. The doctors told the parents to do was to never let them know that these surgeries had happened. You know, there weren't counseling services. There weren't all these things that now doctors will point out have really changed in terms of how we deal with intersex babies. Parents are now, at least at the good hospitals in the U.S. that are a little bit more forward-thinking about this stuff, they're given a lot more resources in terms of how to deal with their kids' condition and how to support them. And the parents themselves are supported. And some more progressive doctors, I talked to one guy out of UCSF and in San Francisco, and he's sort of this new school that says that, you know, we need to only do sort of minimally invasive surgeries. They used to, if a girl was born with an extra large clitoris, for example, they would cut that down to make her look more acceptably like a girl. Now, Dr. Sandro in San Francisco, for example, he won't do that. He'll leave it alone. He says that doesn't meet the bar for what we should operate on. But he does do these sort of minimally invasive reversible surgery so that there is room left over for a kid to make a choice later on in life.
Is that the alternative, to do a minimally invasive surgery that can be reversed rather than just letting them go and be gender ambiguous until they can make a decision with their parents, presumably
right.
later?
I mean, if you talk to the intersex activists, they don't even agree with what Dr. DeSandro is proposing. I mean, a minimally invasive surgery is still a surgery. Why are we operating at all? The issue of informed consent, if you take it even further, I mean, this is an infant that has no agency in terms of making decisions about their own body, right? They're
right.
16 months old.
Mm-hmm.
So the activists really do push that further to exactly what you just said, to let the kid have the choice and make the decision with their parents and their doctors once they are a fully formed human being, once their form of gender identity is more solidified.
Of course, this is, you said, been done since the 1950s. Is there any data at all on outcomes for people who did not have the surgery as a child versus people who had the surgeries?
This is also part of the problem, is that there's so little scientific backing for sort of whether this is a good idea or a bad idea. There have been a couple of studies. They tend to contradict each other because it's a really small sample size. It's both a rare condition and there hasn't been that much research into it. So doctors are really, as of 2011, are starting to sort of team up with researchers to determine sort of those long-term outcomes and see sort of what works best. A lot of what we do have is personal testimonies, and those are a little bit harder to make sense of, obviously, because people will peg them as the good eggs or the bad eggs. But, you know, there are some individuals that grew up without any surgical alteration, and I spoke to one of them for my story, and she claimed she lived a totally normal life. She said that as far as the differences she did have to deal with, you know, going through high school, a lot of the claims made are about that these kids might be bullied for being different. She said that, you know, the most different thing that was perceived about her was the fact that her parents were immigrants, and that was a much harder thing to sort of struggle with in high school.
It's a very big case, and I'm wondering what might happen if the Crawfords do win the case. Will it be so decisive that medical professionals will be forbidden from these surgeries or think twice about it, or there will be some right. medical ethical review board for making these decisions?
Right. I mean, no one really knows what will happen if they win, but they certainly won't be restricted by the law, in the sense that it won't be illegal for these surgeons to continue to operate. What will likely happen is that doctors will stop sort of operating out of fear of similar malpractice suits being brought against them. You know, if this is successful, it sets a precedent for more successful lawsuits, essentially.
Well, Azine, thank you so much. We'd love to check in with you after the case goes to trial.
Yeah, of course.
Azine Gureshi, she's science reporter for BuzzFeed News, and she recently wrote the article called Born in Between, Should Doctors Operate on Intersex Babies? There's a link to read her article along with some really interesting photographs at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Cheryl Glickman is a single 40-something-year-old woman living in Los Angeles. She works for a company that makes self-defense exercise videos. She's got a psychosomatic lump in her throat that prevents her from swallowing and has a nearly obsessive crush on a 60-year-old man who is lusting after a teenaged girl. Cheryl, or more accurately, her ever-chattering brain, narrates The First Bad Man. That's the debut novel of the artist, writer, and filmmaker Miranda July. Maybe you first heard that name when her quirky and charming 2000 film, Me, You, and Everyone We Know, won the special jury prize at Sundance. Since then, she's made a second film, a book of short stories, a messaging app, and has performed all over the world. We spoke to her when the book first came out. It is now out in paperback. So this character, Cheryl Glickman, she is archly funny, I thought anyway. Maybe not on purpose, we imagine, because she's rigidly controlled. Can you tell us about her carefully constructed system, as she calls it, for living alone?
Right. Her system is like the way that she keeps house. And yeah, she lives alone. And I think we all kind of do this, especially when we live alone. Like, you just come up with the most efficient way to do things. So, for example, she doesn't use a bowl or a plate. She just eats right out of the pan to save that amount of dishwashing. And she only has one set of dishes, so they can't accumulate, you know. And there's this thing called carpooling, which is if you're going to move an object to put it, you know, back where it goes in the house, you wait until there's a number of objects that need to go in the same direction, and then you carry them all together. Things like that. Which I should say, like, which sounds so crazy when you isolate them and write them down. But I think people do this kind of thing without thinking.
And it is constantly going on inside of her head, so we know what it is. She's got this inner dialogue that sometimes borders on the delusional, I think. Was indulging in that a fun exercise for you? What was that like for you?
Yeah, it was a joy to write Cheryl. She's sort of like my shadow self that I furiously work to, like, outrun, you know? Like, I have to work very hard all the time every day not to be her.
So she's unfiltered you?
Well, no, she's me if I didn't, like, make things all the time. I mean, I'm making things all the time so that I won't end up being completely inert and alone like her.
Well, you do. You've manifested so much in your life. You know, I'm thinking of this quote from True Detective. I mean, you know, did you watch it, by the way?
I've watched one.
Okay, so the Matthew McConaughey character, he says, life's barely long enough to get good at one thing. And here you are. You write. You've made films. You do performance art. And you make it look kind of easy. Does it just look that way?
Yeah, no, it's as hard as doing just one of those things, which is plenty hard. I mean, I think I myself, if I was listening to the radio and I heard that description, I'd be like, oh, that person isn't taking any of those things seriously, you know, so I'm not going to take that person seriously. I mean, that's actually how I feel when I hear that. But all I can say is I just started out that way. Like, I've never not done this. When my first movie was, you know, kind of a bit of a hit, I was encouraged, like, okay, now just do movies. And it was like, well, but what about all these other things that have been sustaining me, you know, and on all these different levels? Like, I really should just drop all of them because this is the thing, you know, that other people care about or that I could make money on. So it's something I do for myself first and foremost.
I think it's inspired a lot of jealousy, a lot of venom from people. I was reading on the back of your book, there's a blurb by Lena Dunham. And when I was doing research for this interview, I was actually shocked to learn how much you have in common with her in terms of haters. You know, you've inspired a lot of anti-fans. Do you think they have a problem with your work, or is it your ability to just do it all and succeed?
Yeah, at this point, I feel like I don't like that story. The story of haters is almost it's not that it's not true, but it's almost like media generated. Like, I think what Lena and I both experience is our extreme luck to be doing exactly what we want to do with a massive amount of supporters. And yeah, I'd say that neither of us is fitting into the exact way a woman is supposed to be. Like, if you're not perfect, and neither she nor I are perfect or perfectly sexy, then you're supposed to be a little bit apologetic about yourself. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're annoying.
I was actually wondering if it was female-focused.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to Cheryl, because she's the female who is the focus of your book. In this novel, there's a lot of fetishism. There's this blurred line between sex and violence, but in a very literary novel kind of way, very different from, let's say, 50 Shades of Grey, okay?
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about the role that sexuality plays in this book and what you were exploring?
Yeah, well, it's so interesting because this character is actually almost asexual. I mean, she's in her 40s, she's pear-shaped, she's not beautiful. And I guess my way into her was into her sexual fantasies, which I got kind of fascinated by the fact that we do all these things in our sexual fantasies that don't reflect who we are on the outside or who we even want to be. I mean, I think that straight people have gay fantasies. I think that women, without even being aware of it, are often the man in a sexual fantasy, simply because you're thinking about the object of desire, which, whether it's you, you know, or another woman, you're thinking about how nice it feels for the man, you know, which is kind of the way that sex is sold to us. Like, the man is the one kind of having the most fun. And so in talking to friends very carefully and respectfully about this, and thinking about my own inner world, I realized, like, oh, I can have a character completely go off the hook without she herself needing to be freaky or radical in any way. I mean, she's quite a conservative woman, because that is actually how we are.
I'm speaking with the artist and filmmaker and author Miranda July. Her debut novel, The First Bad Man, is now out. It is a wickedly funny book that takes on fetishism, neuroses, motherhood, to the kind of inner dialogue that is running frequently inside of our heads. Well, there is a bit of a spoiler here, but through a weird chain of circumstances, Cheryl actually plays mother to a newborn in a certain point in this book. And there's this passage on page 220 that really struck me, and I'm wondering if you'd be willing to read it for us.
Right, sure. But as the sun rose, I crested the mountain of my self-pity and remembered I was always going to die at the end of this life anyway. What did it really matter if I spent it like this, caring for this boy, as opposed to some other way? I would always be earthbound. He hadn't robbed me of my ability to fly or live forever. I appreciated nuns now, not the conscripted kind, but modern women who chose it. If you were wise enough to know that this life would consist mostly of letting go of things you wanted, then why not get good at the letting go rather than the trying to have? These exotic revelations bubbled up involuntarily, and I began to understand that the sleeplessness and vigilance and constant feedings were a form of brainwashing, a process by which my old self was being molded, slowly but with a steady force, into a new shape, a mother. It hurt. I tried to be conscious while it happened, like watching my own surgery. I hoped to retain a tiny corner of the old me, just enough to warn other women with. But I knew this was unlikely. When the process was complete, I wouldn't have anything left to complain with. It wouldn't hurt anymore. I wouldn't remember.
Miranda July there, reading from her novel, The First Bad Man. I loved that passage because it seemed so authentic to the experience of a recent mother, you know, this sleep-deprived, all-consuming state of early parenting. And I read that you actually handed this book into the publisher just before giving birth yourself. Is that true?
Oh, well, better than that. I handed in the first draft, so I had just gotten started. So I did, in fact, write you know, did all my rewriting and most of the writing of the book in the first 2 years of my son's life.
Okay, so, well, that makes more sense to me because I wondered how you came up with the words that rang so true.
No, I waited. In fact, I wrote a little note to my editor in that first draft. I was like, I'm not even going to bother filling out the baby sections because next week I'll be a mom and I'll know, you know. And it's true that, I mean, that section is one of the few sections in the book that's pretty much taken straight from myself. Mm. It's funny. There was a lot more of myself that I thought was going to end up in the book in terms of being a mother. And it was a process of crossing things out because it's like you come out of this fever dream and you realize, oh, wait, I'm telling a fiction here. Mm. And there are other stories besides my baby story.
Well, I know that in the book, Cheryl works at the pseudo-spiritual martial arts studio turned exercise video outfit. It is very new agey. And meanwhile, I read that you grew up in Vermont where your parents had a publishing company that focused on spirituality and alternative health and martial arts. In the book, the parent characters are very full of psychobabble. I'm wondering if there are autobiographical connections there in The First Bad Man.
Well, yes, for sure. And I think the thing is, if you grow up in that, that's what you have to work with. And you have a pretty deep, complex relationship to it. So, you know, one person might read it as just straight satire. Whereas for me, it's like, well, I know that these are real people, you know, and like, yeah, I can see the humor in it, but I also wouldn't just make fun of it. And I think there is that, it kind of, the book walks that line. Like, you're never sure, like, am I supposed to be believing in this? Mm. And that's kind of how I felt growing up. Like, I'm not ruling out anything. Like, color therapy might be real. I'm very open, but I'm also not going to be completely sold on anything because, you know, I've met so many people who are like, you know, color therapy is their life. And you know, I don't want to be that person either because there's a sort of blindness there. So I'm never quite sure exactly how it reads to the wider world, but it's what I have to work with. And each time I try and move very far away from it, you know, I find my way back.
Well, for this reader, reading about Cheryl taking the essence of red was pretty funny, I have to say. And Miranda, yeah. you starred in both of the feature films that you've made so far. I'm wondering if this book were turned into a movie, would you play Cheryl?
Oh, well, I'm not yet pear-shaped. I don't know if you were saying I was.
No, not at all.
I mean, I think
you could wear prosthetics. That's always good for, you know, getting a lot of good accolades.
Yeah, I don't know if you get an Oscar just for like a big butt. I think if they like age you, or
it's got to be
a nose
or something.
Yeah. Well, you know, I actually very consciously tried to make a story that didn't have a character that I could play because I feel like that's something I get to do in fiction. And when I'm making a movie, thus far, I've always felt like I need to be in it. And therefore, I have to have a character that's pretty much like me because I'm not like a fantastically talented actress. I mean, I can do it, but I don't want to try out being like a working class British woman. Like, I think I'll, you know, stay close to home. So I thought of these characters as looking unlike me. But yes, you're right. I would play Cheryl sooner than I'd play Klee.
I think there are so many good options for Klee.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
But so you have written this novel, a book of short stories. You've made two films. You've created this app. What's next for you?
Oh, I need to buckle down and start writing my next script. Hmm. Filmmaking is one of those things like I don't want to lose it. Like it's such a lucky thing to be able to do. It's so hard, but so worth it. So in between all these interviews and stuff, I write down little ideas, and I know that when I have some quiet time again, that I will just be writing this script.
Miranda July is an artist, a writer, a filmmaker, and whatever else she decides to be. You can find more about her novel, The First Bad Man, which is now out in paperback at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org, including articles where you can find more about the subjects and guests we had on the show. You can also see photographs and videos and more. And you can join the conversation by going to our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. So do you think today's college students are too politically correct? Do you love Miranda July's new book? Share your thoughts and keep the conversation going. And if you like the show, share it on social media or pass it along. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.